I was trying to go for a long pause so I know where the break is.
And here I'm trying to help by providing my personal elevator music.
Yes.
When all is ready, I throw this switch.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Collected Edition, a comic book podcast where we discuss the famous and infamous runs and story arcs throughout the history of comics. I'm Paul Matthew Carr, and with me, as always, is Brian Rees.
Hey, Paul, how's it going?
It's going really well, I think.
You recovered from the holidays?
I suppose. did you have a happy new year?
I did. It was a joyous new year.
Was it?
Yes.
It was just sort of quiet for me.
Oh, well, same here, but you know.
But it was, in fact, joyous, yes.
It was, in fact, joyous, because when we select a random day of the year in which to switch our calendars over, here
we are. Is it a random day of the year?
Well, it sort of is. I mean, dates are random. Time is random.
Time is a mystery.
You know, we have assigned, as humans, strictures on how we judge time and the passage of said thing.
Yeah, but I always thought it was a neat little way to do things, because it's at the darkest moment and it starts getting lighter, so that's when you start your new year, when things start getting brighter again.
But then it should be like, what, 10 days earlier?
Well, I don't know, man.
But that interferes with Jesus's birthday.
You mean in November? I read the Bible.
No, Paul, it was December 25th. It is known.
It is known.
It is known.
Okay, I'm not going
to. You're going to edit that out, aren't you?
I don't know. We'll see what happens. but anyway, today on the program, we'll be talking about Sandman Mystery Theater, specifically the arcs of Dr. Death and Night of the Butcher, written by Mark Wagner, not Steven Seagal, Steven Siegel, with art by Vince Locke and Guy Davis. I wrote Seagal down, is what I'm saying. I'm looking at my notes. I'm like, Steven Seagal, interesting. But first, we're going to talk about some other things going on in the world of comics. Brian.
Yes, Paul.
I don't know if you've noticed this, but something that I've been noticing recently, and we don't need to spend a whole lot of time on this. I just wanted to get your take on it. It seems that the 90s, or at least the 90s aesthetic, is beginning to reemerge in comics.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. So if you look at things like the metal crossover in DC, or Batman Damned for that matter, and Shatterstar has his own comic.
Shatterstar.
Yeah, I know.
Does he? And so without feet, I believe.
Lots of rocks on the ground where he could hide his feet. So it seems that the extreme character and character design and violent storytelling is coming back. Like a bad sandwich you had for lunch that's been sitting in the sun all day with extra mayo. It's coming.
Even better, egg salad.
Yeah. So how do you feel about this? I think I've given my feelings away.
You buried the lead. I think actually our last podcast, when I was talking about my worst comic of the year, which was New Challengers.
Yeah, there you go.
And to me, that was, so I sort of shared rather vociferously, I think, my feelings on that comic. But that is precisely an example of this 90s retro idea that
it's understandable.
I was so happy. It was such a nice thing when we finally put the 90s behind us.
I know.
I think there were some very, very, very good comics released in the 90s. Apparently, Neil Gaiman wrote some kind of comic in the 90s that people think highly of.
That's adjacent to what we're doing here.
Right. In keeping with sort of our theme here, I know that you might have some concerns about the comic we're covering today that you've let me know in advance. But, there were some very good comics coming out in the 90s, but there was some garbage. And even Image,
Image was...
The Image started was...
If you had told me that Image would be what it is today, back in the 90s, I would have laughed in your face.
Exactly.
No.
Right.
There's no way that's going to happen. Now, this...
But not just not just Image, right? But
No. It's superhero comics primarily, I think, right. And DC and Marvel in particular. You know, there was Vertigo going on, and it had its issues as well, but that was something different. I'm talking more about superhero comics and right. Azrael Batman and that sort of thing.
Yeah. And Azrael is now, like, people really love Azrael, the character, and which I don't get. I've always hated that character.
Yeah, I don't get it.
Your other folks' mileage may vary, but, yeah. You know, he's back in the spotlight in DC. Marvel is doing their ad campaigns now where they're using the graphics and sort of the ad campaigns that they used to do. They're going retro into the 90s and using that same sort of style of ad campaign.
Right. Yeah. I mean, you know, it's undeniable. It is something that is all over comics in general. And, you know, it is understandable. You know, it's been 20 years. And the people who grew up in the 90s and they were exposed to comics for the first time at that time with, like, Age of Apocalypse and Death of Superman, that's right. Now the target audience. And they're right. the ones writing and drawing comics now. So it's inevitable that 90s, you know, nostalgia is going to come back.
Which is, and it's just sort of, it's like commercials you see now. Because we are now sort of the target money group for advertising. So you watch commercials. What songs are they playing in ads right now? They're playing songs from our generation. They used to play songs from the 60s. The 70s were like, you know, then followed that with, you know.
With the 80s and then the 90s.
Right, the target demographic. And now we're getting like the 80s and the 90s are the songs that they're using in all of these ads to try to get, you know, the assumption that we're somehow like a major commerce force.
Yeah, we're a revenue for some reason.
Right.
Yeah, it's almost like time keeps on ticking into the future. But, all right, so I to get back to this, I'm not exactly pleased with the return of the 90s because I wasn't a fan of 90s superhero comics. I don't look forward to Big Guns and Small Feet. That's not what I was really into.
Impossible torsos. And
yeah.
And breasts that just don't make sense.
Yeah, and women who can show their butts and breasts at the same time.
Right.
Yeah, it was just unbelievable. But, okay, all that being said, I do want to point out that, you know, for me, I bang on about 70s comics till everyone is probably bored out of their skulls. And I get the nostalgia thing. The majority of my entertainment and the majority of the things I write about in one way or another involves nostalgia, and it's usually nostalgia for a time, for my time. Right. So
yes.
I don't want to just completely dismiss this as old man yells at clown kind of thing. Because people do have a lot of strong feelings about it. They do love it.
And sometimes that cloud needs to be scolded.
Yes. Don't you dare get on my lawn. but my sincere hope is that the 90s aesthetic can be done with a 2000 teens mindset and awareness.
Yeah. And I think in some ways, some writers are threading that needle pretty well. Some writers, I see Marvel is doing it a little bit more than DC, but that's not entirely fair because DC certainly, like again, back to my pick for worst comic of last year, was a DC comic.
Well, there's some stuff going on in Heroes United. Is that what it's called? Heroes in Crisis.
Heroes in Crisis.
Yeah. That's interesting.
Well, it's actually, that's kind of intriguing because... They're killing them, which is a retrospective that I could maybe get behind.
that's about as crisis as you can get.
Right. Yeah. Well, you know, it's not a crisis if you're not killing off a bunch of heroes, a bunch of, you know, sort of lame heroes that you haven't used in a while. Well, let's clear the decks.
Yeah.
And we could blame Crisis on Infinite Earths for that. You could blame Crisis on Infinite Earths for a lot of things, but I would not blame it as a piece of work because I actually am quite still today fond of that series, and maybe we'll cover that someday down the
line. So you're nostalgic about it?
Sure.
Yeah. Yeah. I just hope that this whole 90s return is going to be, I hope it can be done better the second time around. Is what I'm saying.
Or at least done away with quickly.
We will see.
You're right.
I can't wait for the return of the early 2000s.
Yeah.
On that note, there is another thing going on this week. Is it this week?
It is this week. It's starting this week.
Yeah, so premiering on Sci-Fi will be...
Yes, I'm pretty excited about this. Yeah. So Deadly Class, a comic on Image by Rick Remender and Wes Craig, has been one of my favorite comics the last several years. And it's a really great comic. And so Sci-Fi is... So it got optioned for a TV show. And, you know, a lot of times when you hear creators talk about how the show got optioned for something, and then they get excited about it. They talk about it for a few months, and then they stop talking about it because it just got optioned and never came to fruition. But Deadly Class by Rick Remender and Wes Craig is now going to be a Sci-Fi TV show. And I haven't seen it yet. I know the first episode dropped online on purpose, like Sci-Fi put it out several weeks ago, and I didn't watch it then. Because I kind of wanted to just wait. Let me wait till it's on the TV machine and I'll watch it, you know, week to week and what have you. But Deadly Class is, the series is set, it's a school for assassins. And set in the 80s. Talk about nostalgia. There's your nostalgia, Paul.
Yep. The 80s are big right now.
With all of the... all of the music references is rife with music references of the time and also some politics of the time. The title of the first episode may even reference Reagan.
Well, the first trade is called Reagan Youth.
Right.
So
I don't read it. I read the individual, the floppies, just to drive some people nuts if I call them floppies. never sure what the trades are called, but it's really an incredible comic that is full of some, first of all, it's incredibly violent. It's set for a school for assassins. Now the school is, when we say school, we're talking school age, like high school age. So these are all kids from like 14 to 17 or what have you.
Do they age up as it goes? Okay. I should point out that.
Yes, they age up if they make it.
Yeah. So I have read the first trade, which covers the first six issues, and it's great.
Right.
But I always meant to go on with it, but I always forget. You could say, right. I never remember to read it.
Oh,
but that being said, it is what I've read of it is really great. And so but I'm asking as the series goes on, do the kids actually age with the?
Yes, they absolutely age, and each story arc, as is common nowadays, they take a break in between story arcs, you know, a couple months break. And, when the new story arc begins, it's the next year.
Oh, okay. So like Harry Potter for assassins.
Right. So it's Harry Potter for assassins with a whole lot more violence and sex and punk rock. But, okay. So I really enjoy the series and I am very curious. You can't tell with these shows, but the Sci-Fi has done a very good job. I thought they did a really good job with Happy, the Grant Morrison, Derek Robertson comic. And I thought, you know, obviously The Expanse is one of the best shows that has been on television in the last several years.
I just started watching that. That's how far behind I am with television.
And so, you know, I kind of have a little bit of faith in Sci-Fi these days. Some of their stuff is junk, but so is every network. I'm actually pretty excited. I could be wrong. By the time this posts, the first episode will be out, and maybe I'll be very angry. And
well, as far as, you know, as far as the production of things is concerned, it's being run by the Russo brothers, who are right now the sort of, you know, go-to directors for the MCU. So they've done Winter Soldier, Civil War, and Infinity War, which are three of my favorites, you know, but three of the best movies, I think, in the MCU right now. So they know their stuff,
right?
You know, and the story itself is very, you know, it's made for television.
It sort of is, and the fact that Sci-Fi, like we saw with Happy, Sci-Fi is sort of like FX. They're gonna let language and violence just kind of happen.
Yeah, and the star is one of the stars. I don't really know. I'm not familiar with many of the cast. I looked them up online, and I said, well, okay. I don't know any.
Yeah, I don't know any of the cast except Henry Rollins is in it.
Yeah, and Benedict Wong. You can't go Wong with Benedict Wong. He's great. He actually, which is amazing, he actually plays Wong in Doctor Strange. So it's Benedict yes. Wong plays Wong. And so, and I think that's right because two Wongs make a Wong. I couldn't even get that out. I enjoyed that. Enjoyed that joke.
At some point, somewhere, there's going to be an article, you know, local Chicago podcaster kills himself after many tons by made by.
But yes, I do look forward to it. It looks good.
Yeah, I mean, it's a great concept. It definitely works as a serialized. It definitely, I don't think Remender wrote it with the idea to make it into a TV show, but he wrote it in such a way. He wrote it serialized, like with comics. And so I think that the transition from the page to the screen will be very interesting. I'll be very interested to see what changes they do, because you always have to do changes, which is fine. I've never had problems with that.
No, adaptation is what it is. You have to adapt things.
Yeah. Right. I mean, you know, Preacher, the show, which I have issues with, but my issues aren't with them changing around the show for it to be completely different than the comic. My issues are different than that. So I have no problem with, you know, I mean, you don't want to just present the same thing over and over and over again. So.
Right. And everybody has a different vision. So mm-hmm. It's a different medium. It needs to be adapted for that medium. So you got to take that in.
People get all riled up about some film adaptation that doesn't exactly mirror something they read is just absurd, you know, unless you want to watch like a 20-hour film.
Yeah, and you have to judge something by what it is, not what you want it to be.
Yeah.
You know.
So anyway, I'm very excited about that, and I'm really hoping that it turns out to be pretty good. I guess our next podcast I will have... If we have time, I'll maybe share my feelings.
And I'm probably good. Well, we'll see. I'm a busy guy. I don't know if I'm going to watch it, but I'll try. And then we can share. We can compare notes.
Right. Yeah. We can share our feelings.
Yep. Hey.
Hey.
Maybe we should take a break and come back and talk about Sandman Mystery Theater.
Sounds like a plan.
All right.
I'm Ruth.
And I'm Darren of the Rad Adventures Network.
We're a married couple who enjoy great stories of all kinds, including adventures, mysteries, science fiction, and fantasy.
Please join us for a variety of podcasts focused on a range of pop culture topics.
Trekker Talk is about 23rd century bounty hunter Mercy St. Clair from the comic Trekker by writer and artist Ron Randall. It's a blend of classic sci-fi adventures and noir mysteries set in a retro future.
Xenozoic Xenophiles is about the comic Xenozoic Tales by writer and artist Mark Schultz. It's a post-apocalyptic adventure series filled with Cadillacs and dinosaurs.
Warlord Worlds covers the many comics of writer and artist Mike Grell, including The Warlord, John Sable, Green Arrow, and the Legion of Superheroes.
Sensational Sleuths, where we talk about favorite mystery novels, movies, and TV shows.
Fantastic Fantasies, where we share our favorite fantasy films and books.
And Amazing Adventures, where we discuss action-packed adventure stories.
Listen on Podbean, iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and YouTube. And follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram.
Or visit radadventuresnetwork.com to find all of our shows and links to our social media pages.
That's RAD, R-A-D, which is short for Ruth and Darren.
And we're back. So today on the program, we'll be talking about Sandman Mystery Theater. And Brian, this was your recommendation, so take it away.
Thank you, Paul. So today we're going to discuss Sandman Mystery Theater. Sandman Mystery Theater was a series published by Vertigo Comics from 1993 to 1999. It was written by Matt Wagner and Stephen T. Siegel, with most art done by the great Guy Davis. The structure of the series revolved around four-issue cases, wherein Wesley Dodds, a.k.a. The Sandman, solved, along with his paramour and detective in her own right, Diane Belmont, an increasingly bizarre and macabre series of murders and crimes, many of which fall into the serial category. The setting was New York in the late 1930s and forward, with a war looming and racial issues bubbling over. The series makes many mentions of the events in Europe leading to World War II and the racial tension in America at the time, both of which are often used as a backdrop to the motivations of the criminals Diane and Wesley work to bring to justice. The relationship between Wesley and Diane is very akin to Dashiell Hammett's Nick and Nora Charles from his Thin Man series. The stories are told in a pulp noir style and continue to expand on a universe of fascinating recurring characters. The basis for Wesley's crusading comes from his disturbing dreams, which are suggested to come from Sandman, Dream of the Endless, who in Neil Gaiman's mythology is currently imprisoned by Roderick Burgess and unable to fulfill his duties. It is not always clear how Dream is able to communicate with Dodds or why Dodds is the recipient of Dream's unconscious, but it is the black and white dream sequence that features a very obvious but masked Morpheus that suggests to Dodds the course he must take. Intriguingly, each case arc alternates between Diane and Wesley's perspective, with the narrator providing their own unique voice, not just the cases, but on the nature of humanity, love, and duty. Today we are looking at the fifth trade collection, which contains the stories Dr. Death and the Night of the Butcher. In Dr. Death, Dodd takes on a pharmacist looking to end the lives of the elderly and infirm, while Diane finally confirms her suspicions that Wesley is indeed the Sandman. In Night of the Butcher, Wesley and Diane continue to dance around their relationship while working to solve one of the most disturbing cases, a possible cannibal living in the sewers of New York. So, first of all, you know, of course there's a cannibal living in the sewers of New York.
Well, yeah, with an alligator.
With an alligator. But part of the reason I recommended this series is some of it's nostalgia. I remember loving this series when it came out. And as someone who himself is a big fan of pulp, you know, hard-boiled kind of crime pulp novels, this particular series has always fed right into sort of my wheelhouse, as it were. And so it's been actually kind of fun. I've gone back and reread the entire series researching for these particular issues, and I picked these two story arcs because these are the story arcs in which Diane and Wesley, in which Diane actually confirms her suspicions and confronts Wesley about who he is, and it is the beginning of really their partnership, I think, which I think is one of the best partnerships that has been represented. Definitely in comics, but also in sort of the world of literature and beyond. So just a little extra history on why I selected these two stories in particular, rather than, say, the beginning or the very fascinating ending of the series. So anyway, Paul, this was my recommendation. You were reading this not for the first time, but probably for the first time in a while. Do you have any initial thoughts or feelings from?
Yeah, I admit I'm a little bit torn on this one. Now, back in the day, you know, I was a huge Sandman fan. So anything Sandman related or adjacent, I just ate it up. Everything at all. Like, you know, right. I read Books of Magic and Lucifer and The Dreaming, you know, everything that was Sandman related, I was reading. So of course I picked this one up as well. And I remember at the time really, really liking it, but going back to it, I was taken by how not taken by it I was. And,
fair point, yes.
Yes. So maybe you can't go back again. But I really wanted, I do want to point out that it's kind of a tale of two stories here. I think my problems are with Dr. Death, whereas Night of the Butcher I actually enjoyed. So maybe it was just one story hit me the wrong way.
Well, and I think Dr. Death is the lesser of the two stories. And I think we both agree on that. I think that, you know, and there are definite reservations with things in Dr. Death, as I have with some of the previous stories. Some of the previous stories, story arcs also had issues in them that had me sort of scratching my head a little bit and not feeling quite comfortable either. And yeah. I think Dr. Death has a few of those instances as well. And it's not, and it, you know, like the art, I think, was something you have mentioned that you didn't particularly love in Dr. Death.
Yeah, in Dr. Death, it's Vince Locke, and it's not Guy Davis.
Right.
And Vince Locke, I found his art to be just muddy, and kind of all the characters looked the same to me. It's not as dynamic and as vibrant as Guy Davis's work in Night of the Butcher.
Right.
Just something simple as how it's framed. You know, in Dr. Death, it's usually just people standing there talking, and there's nothing really dynamic going on, whereas in Night of the Butcher, Guy Davis is doing different angles and different, you know, he's presenting the scene differently. And it's really night and day when you see it. It really, literally.
And I tend to agree. I much prefer Guy Davis's art, although I find Guy Davis's art fascinating, and I find his representations of the characters interesting, because even with Guy Davis's art, they change. Their appearances change, and I don't mean change in that he doesn't know what he's doing, but they change in terms of they get bigger in size and smaller in size sometimes from arc to arc, which I think was an intentional sort of people are getting older. They're following a real timeline.
Right. And they don't have superhero physiques.
Right. You know? Nobody. Yeah.
These are real people. And they have, when you have your main, you know, superhero character and he's a pudgy little guy, that's
right.
You know, as a pudgy little guy myself,
balding with glasses.
Yeah. I'm digging that. No, I really appreciate that, actually.
Yeah. So I think for me with Dr. Death it's kind of a generic pulp story in some ways. It's a murder case. It features a very despicable sort of villain. And the main reason for this, I think it is one of the lesser stories in the canon, but the main reason, again, to reiterate that I picked it was this is the story arc in which Diane stumbles into, or, well, not stumbles, she's intentionally looking for, she has figured out that Wesley is the Sandman, and...
Yeah, she did a little minor sleuthing there, which is...
Yeah, and she may actually be, well, it's not maybe, I think going forward we see she might actually be the better detective than Wesley Dodds. She has figured out that he's a Sandman, and she basically sets about to prove that he is, and so she snoops around his place after a night of sweet, sweet lovemaking, and discovers his little hidden lair.
If you know what I mean.
and then of course confronts him. Well, he walks in on her after she has discovered it. They confront him, and their relationship goes pretty sour from there because she thinks he's nuts.
That kind of
he tells her about his dreams, and it's his dreams that compel him to dress up in, you know, this odd World War I gas mask and, you know, run around the city, you know, shooting chemicals at people.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, he has a sort of semi-clairvoyant. Now, forgive me. Like I said, I haven't read this in quite a while, and I haven't gone back to read the first few issues. What is dreams? A dream as in Morpheus, the Neil Gaiman Sandman. What is his connection other than the fact that he shows up in dreams every once in a while?
Well, it's never explicitly laid out. Some of this, one of the things that this series does well, even though some of it seems a little trite, you know, and very 90s by our standards today, is it allows some mysteries to remain mysteries. And ostensibly the idea is that, you know, like in my intro, Dream has been captured by Roderick Burgess and has entered basically along, pardon me, sleep.
Yes.
And what is happening is
a big sleep.
Sleep. Thank you.
There you go.
There's your Chandler reference. the idea is, I believe it's his unconscious reaching out to another mind.
Okay.
And
that's kind of what I got from the gist of the dream sequences. It's really hard when there's a person named Dream and he's in a dream.
There's a dream in a dream, and that dream is Sandman, who's also talking to Sandman.
Yes, so that it tends to make things a bit confusing. But any that is the gist I got from those sequences. But I wasn't sure if I missed something.
In some ways, you could argue that the connection is quite tenuous, and the idea was to have thrown all of that in there merely to. I mean, they're reviving a character named Sandman whilst. You know, because Sandman was a Golden Age character and was an existing character that DC holds the property to, it was inevitable that when the Neil Gaiman Sandman became popular,
hugely popular
being an understatement,
yeah,
you know, somebody, whether it be Matt Wagner or somebody at the Vertigo offices, said, hey, you know, we should find a way to bring the other Sandman into this and capitalize on the name Sandman. And this is apocryphal. I don't know if this is what happened, you know, and so people sat around and were sort of like, well, how do we do this? What tenuous connection can we make? Oh, well, we'll just have, you know, Wesley dreaming of Sandman and So it could have been just as generic as they were trying to find an inn to connect Gaiman Sandman from the Golden Age Sandman, or to the Golden Age Sandman.
Right. And I get that. I mean, yeah, more power to him. That this was a gold mine in the 90s. Vertigo pretty much made a name for itself on Sandman and Sandman related titles.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, there were other great books they were putting out.
Oh yeah. But that's what I'm saying is, like, Vertigo became a thing on the back of Sandman.
Right.
Yes, there were other things, and I'm simplifying it extremely, but come on.
But Sandman's... It was their money shot.
Yeah. Oh, wow. Yes, absolutely. So the Thin Man, do you think that was just a sort of coincidence that I'm trying to be coy, but Wesley and Diane are totally the Thin Man.
Right. The thing is that I'd have to check my dates to be certain, but you know, in the original Golden Age Sandman, it was Wesley and Diane as well.
Yes. But if you look at them, especially the Kirby stuff, this is a totally different book.
Right. So they existed as a crime-solving duo of sorts, even back in the day. That's a good question, because I don't have the dates in front of me as to when Thin Man, the publication dates of Thin Man versus the publication date of Sandman. I would think the Thin Man was first, but I don't want to...
Yeah, I'm almost positive. I think the Thin Man novels came out in the 20s.
But for its usage, you know, I mean, Diane eventually kind of fell to the background in the Golden Age Sandman, and then of course he got his young partner Sandy and he joined the Justice League, and there was all, you know, so but with the iteration that we're talking about, it's absolutely, they're taking the, you know, I think Wagner and Siegel are pulling from both the original Golden, you know, the original Sandman comic, and also from Hammett's, you know, Nick and Nora Charles. He has to be, and it's a perfectly wonderful nod to both the novels and the films. Can't forget the films.
Oh, the films, yeah, films are classics
as well. So yes, I would say, you know, it's definitely a callback, and it's definitely intentional, and they are definitely using it as a springboard.
Just so you know, I'm probably going to edit this. The Dashiell Hammett novel, Thin Man, came out in 1934. Might as well get some facts straight. I don't typically do that. But no, I love that idea. The noir, hard-boiled detective pastiche that they're going for in this is really well done. And there's the dialogue and some of the just little quirks of the time feel authentic. Mm-hmm. You could probably speak to that more than I could, with the authenticity of this thing. Well, no, you
since I was born and raised in the 30s.
You read and watch and you're caught up in this era, so you right. know more than I do.
Well, no, I mean, and the series, it hits all the right sort of, it hits all the right tones, and it is a love story in many ways to the old pulps and the old crime novels. I mean, throughout the comic, even you see people are reading the pulp magazines of the time, and there is even there's a panel where someone is reading a Sandman pulp novel or a Sandman pulp magazine, and from tone and from sort of the coloring, even you know, you talk about like with Vince Locke, like it being a little muddy, and even Guy Davis tends to use like sort of the muted tones, the muted colors. There's a lot of brown.
Yeah, but with Guy Davis, at least you can get the idea that it's sort of sepia toned nostalgia. Right.
Yeah.
You know, and whereas with Locke, it's just sort of muddy, in my opinion.
Right. Yeah. And you could tell the difference between the characters.
Is that just me? Or is I just, I mean.
No, there is, with Dr. Death, it is definitely, you notice the difference. Yeah. In the art. Guy Davis, I believe, did the layouts, and Vincent Locke did the finishes. So you do have, but you know, it's...
It looks dramatically different to me.
But no, I think, you know, it hits all of the sort of, even thematically, it definitely touches on a lot of the sort of 30s and 40s ideas and tropes. Yeah. As it were. I mean, you have, you know, you have the looming war you have the specter of, you know, racism is all around and is not really, it's not candy coated. It's not covered over. And I think Matt Wagner uses that sometimes successfully, sometimes not, but he uses that to distinguish sort of the more progressive or forward thinking folks in the work, like Wesley Dodds and Diane Belmont, right. To separate them out from another one of the pseudo heroes of the books, Lieutenant Burke. I wouldn't call him a hero, but he is technically a good guy.
Yeah, I actually love the portrayal of Burke because he is a complete ass and he's not a great person, but he's good at his job. He definitely has the right intentions. And you get a little bit of sense because you see a little bit of his home life and you get a little bit of a sense of there's something else underneath the surface of this rough, gruff exterior. Right. So I like Burke a lot.
But he's not a forward thinker when it comes to race.
No. He's not a forward thinker at all. He threatens to beat up witnesses constantly. You know, that's not what we think of as
a hero. There's a scene where they have to like dig up the basement of a restaurant. And Burke is like, he starts like, you know, knocking over all the pots and pans of the food and everything like that. And, you know, the proprietor is like, I'm going to have you arrested. And he's like, you're going to have me arrested? I'm a cop.
Yeah. He's incredibly human. Yeah. Just an authentic character of the time. I appreciated Burke quite a bit. I did get a little tedious of, I'm going to get the Sandman. It always ended with Wesley just barely escaping.
And every time, and usually gassing Burke.
Yeah. Oh, there. That was one in one of the scenes. Burke gets gassed and he's like, "Oh no, not again."
Or he's always like, whenever he walks into a room where someone has been gassed, he's like, "What's that smell?" It's like there is a sort of recurring thing that I don't have an official count, but I can tell you it's not just these two story arcs. It's a whole group of story arcs, maybe every story arc and multiple times in each story arc, where Burke walks in on the Sandman rooting through somebody's files or desk. I don't know if you caught that in these two stories, but it happened multiple times. It's like there are so many scenes of, you know, Wesley Dodds gets, you know, as the Sandman gets to wherever he's going to get information, a library or somebody's office or a storage room in a chemical plant or wherever he's going, Wesley is always rooting through people's files.
Yep. Now that you mentioned
it. Constantly rooting through people's files. And Burke is constantly walking in on him going through somebody's file drawer. And I don't know if this was meant to be like a running gag or not. Possibly by the end, someone probably should have pointed it out to them that they're like, you know, you have a lot of scenes with Wesley going through files.
Now that you mentioned it, I do remember that. Hard to say whether it was a recurring theme or just...
But it's always Burke walking in on him, and it's always Burke getting gassed because of it. You'd think Burke would eventually learn, you know, just go somewhere else.
Yeah.
We need to go look at records from the city. Burke should be like, no.
Perhaps Burke should carry a gas mask himself.
Well, I think you just solved all of the man's problems.
So in Night of the Butcher, I don't know, was inbred cannibal hillbilly a trope at that point? Because it's kind of a trope now.
Well, I think, you know, it certainly reflects how people in the city would think about those outside of the city.
Yeah.
Particularly in rural areas.
I mean, you had like Chainsaw Massacre. So that's sort of that idea of the crazy hillbillies out in the middle of nowhere was around.
Yeah.
And I do remember there was an X-Files episode similar to this. So I was just trying to think, like, was this a trope that was going on at the time?
I think do you mean in the 90s when this was written or in the 30s when...
No, when the series is meant
to take place.
I'm thinking in the 90s.
Okay.
Because this series does lean heavily on certain tropes that were going on in the 90s.
Right. Well, you reflect your current situation by looking back at...
It's very much of its time. But I didn't know if that was...
I think the concept of inbred hillbillies has always been a matter of concern for folks.
But it's the inbred cannibal hillbilly.
Right, cannibal hillbilly. I can't speak for the 90s, how much inbred cannibal hillbillies were a thing.
Let's just say inbred cannibal hillbilly as many times as possible.
what is great about this particular story arc and is, and I think it's one of the better story arcs in terms of just from the pure pulp level, things get a little more complex. And again, the World War II and more international events start to really come into play later on in Sandman Mystery Theater. So I think Night of the Butcher, what it really reminds me of is, like you mentioned, the X-Files before. And, you know, I think of, like, this is one of, like, it's Fluke Man, the Fluke Man episode about the guy living in the sewers or whatever, that's, or the creature living in the sewers that eats poop or, you know, it's just, you know.
I believe that's how Chris Carter pitched it. Guy living in the sewers.
But this is, you know, it's one of the X-Files' most memorable episodes because it's self-contained. It's not mythology. It's not part of the mythology. It's just, you know, a creature of the week. And I think Night of the Butcher was initially like that. It was like creature of the week, this particular story arc. But it really works because it's really nasty.
Oh, it is. And there's no, like, you keep wanting there to be a reason why, because, you know, the killer is killing just random people.
Right.
And you want there to be a reason why, like he has some kind of connection to them or there's a motivation. There's no motivation. This is just an awful person who is randomly selecting people.
Yeah. And you know, and it, initially it's what's interesting is, and it does give a little hint as to what's to come. There is an initial suspicion that it's a hate crime and that the killer is targeting Jewish folks.
But that also ties into, this is one of the few times this comic is actually somewhat subtle, mm-hmm. is the only reason that they're targeting Jewish folks is because they're underprivileged and living in these slums, and the slums are easier to get into.
Right.
So, and that's kind of a subtle dig, you know, because right. Normally it's pretty, this is not a subtle comic.
No, it's you know, pulp. It's exactly. Not intended to be overly subtle. This creature, well, I'm going to call him a creature. It's a human being, but it's a vastly inbred, very mutated.
And he's wearing the skins of other people.
After consuming portions of them. But yeah. They never give his history. The closest we get is when they find that picture down in his lair in the sewer. And it's one panel, and it just shows a picture, and Burke makes a joke about, you know, and we're given to believe that that's probably his parents, but his parents are probably also brother and sister. Yeah. And that's it. That's all you get in terms of any history is one panel with a joke by Burke.
Yeah, and I think it works better. It adds to the creepiness factor that we don't know anything about this person other than he's obviously been living in the sewers for quite a long time.
Right.
And his... we might call it workshop, is just awful.
Yeah. But it works because you don't need to know. And I should clarify that there's nothing fantastical about this. This is, the series is rooted, except for the weird dream sequences that Wesley has that may or may not be Morpheus. That, you know, this isn't, you know, when I say creature of the week, these people, the villains in the story arcs in Sandman Mystery Theater are not creatures. They are human beings.
Right. Absolutely.
There's no fantasy or sci-fi element attached to this.
And I do like in the storytelling in this particular story in Night of the Butcher, there's two elements that are going on simultaneously. One is Burke is actually doing some sleuthing, you know, some detective work, which is nice to see.
Who knew?
In a detective story. And Wesley is also trying to do some detective work, but he's been injured by Burke, as a matter of fact.
Right.
And it's really great to see him trying to do his job while being incredibly injured and not sure if he'll make it back.
Right.
You know, so and those, you know, those are really interesting dynamics to the story.
And as we pointed out, you know, he is not, it's, I'm always surprised whenever he wins fights because Wesley Dodds is not, you know, he's a pudgy, pasty white dude with glasses.
Yeah. He does have, you know, a sleep gun.
Which helps, but as we see in this story arc, if he loses his gun, he gets himself into some trouble.
Right, unless there's a helpful librarian around.
Right.
To save him.
The whack Burke on the head.
I did, that is one aspect I sort of laughed at, because Burke beats the crap out of Wesley. He gets distracted, Wesley just gives him a little zap of the gun, and then stumbles off, but he's really hurt. You would think Burke at some point would just wake up and say, okay, now let's go search the area. But he doesn't. He just says, oh, got away from me again. You know, and I realize the story would be over if he were caught, or the series would be over. But I couldn't help but say, like, eh, yeah, oh, darn it, missed him again.
But I really like I really like the way the story is carried out over these four issues. There's it sounds like it's, you know, an open and shut case. You know, I think the pacing and the plotting of the story arc is incredibly well done, and it could have been done, you know, when you think generically about the story, it's cops and Sandman chase down cannibal killer in sewer. Doesn't sound like it would be, you know, that long of a story arc. You know, you could do it in an issue, whatever. But I think that because of the world building that is going on in Sandman Mystery Theater, and because of the supporting cast of characters, I mean, we haven't talked about one of my favorite, which is Hubert Klein, the mortician and budding young CI.
Yes, CSI Jazz Age.
Or CSI, yes. Budding young CSI before CSIs existed. You know, he gets to have portions of these issues where his character is being developed. And, you know, like we said, Burke has it. We see Larry Belmont, who is Diane's father, is the district attorney, also being able to develop his character. And you also have these subtle, one of the issues opens up with people sitting in a bar talking about Hitler invading Austria.
Right.
And it's just done as background noise.
I mean, it really does set the stage. It mm-hmm. it adds an atmosphere to the whole proceedings there. Yeah, and it's quite well done. And like I said, there's little things that are going on in the story to add more depth to it. Mm-hmm. Just things that are going on with the characters, things that are going on, you know.
Wesley's friend Robert Lee.
Yes.
Who is Chinese, and they try to go to a jazz club together, and they initially are going to deny Robert Lee entrance into the jazz club because of the color of his skin.
Yes, and not only that, they call him Japanese. He's like,
right,
Chinese, but you know.
But it's a small, you know, two or three panel thing, but it sets sort of the atmosphere of the times.
Yeah.
And I think one of the things that Sandman Mystery Theater does is, you know, it's very concerned with sort of the moral decay and corruption of the 30s. And all of the little sort of what we would think of as subtle things, the underlying issues going on in society, the severe level of corruption, both in positions of power and also just amongst the populace, that are contributing to sort of the problems of the era. And the comic really works in all of those things without being preachy, without being, occasionally preachy.
Yeah, I was going to say, occasionally.
But there are also some of the more subtle aspects that it works in that you see as the bigger picture the longer you read, and the more you read and you think back, oh, there was that one panel scene back a few issues ago, or there was this one thing that happened there. It's a very dark series. I mean, it is, you know, pulp noirish crime, so of course it is, but it's dark not just in the sort of criminal cases that are being solved in each story arc, but in its approach about society as a whole.
Exactly. I agree. And you know, this is the heart of the height of the Depression, and it lets that there's a sense of hopelessness that just sort of permeates the entire series, which they come out of it when World War II begins.
Right.
To a certain extent. But in this part of the storylines, there is a sense of Wesley and Diane are socialites. So you are seeing a little bit of a different viewpoint, but you can see a real, there's a lot of class differentiation. People are being killed in the slums and no one really cares until it gets to be so brutal that the cops can't ignore it any further.
Right. You know, I mean, Night of the Butcher, like where they're even having to hide the fact that it's most likely a cannibal.
Yes. Burke has to keep telling cops on the beat there, you did not hear any of that conversation. Don't let me hear you say, don't let me hear this get around.
There are times where I think sometimes Dodds is presented as being almost too good and too much of a sort of shining moral light. That is one thing that's always kind of nagged at me a little bit.
Oh.
You know, that his ideas are so advanced culturally and socially. And, you know, you occasionally wonder, I mean, it alludes to the time he spent time in Asia and traveling abroad, which would certainly work to contribute some.
Well, yeah, I mean, this is revisionist history, you know, so you got to expect a little bit of that, because creating a hero, you're going to put your current views on that person. But at the same time, you know, there was some progressiveness going on at that time as well.
Sure.
Maybe it wasn't as vocal as it is today, but it was going on. So it's not too far-fetched in my mind.
Yeah.
And if you look at the supernatural element of Dream is also kind of working through him, you can kind of, you can play it off that way if you like.
Right. So, I mean, I think one of the biggest takeaways I have for this, first of all, I recommend the series mostly because of the nature of it, you know, the crime aspects of it and what have you. But I think it also, the relationship between Diane and Wesley is also one of the it continues and will always be a driving force throughout the series. And speaking of, Diane is trapped in many ways by the perception that she as a woman needs to just, shouldn't be involving herself in, you know, showing up at crime scenes, or she should just be on a ranch riding horses or attending social functions. And it's something that she certainly bucks against, but you know, for the first half of the series, she has trouble finding her way. It's not till basically these issues that her skills as a sleuth really comes out, and she starts to like find, for lack of a better word, purpose, because she's not afforded the ability or luxury to find it on her own, nor has she been encouraged to.
Yeah,
because, you know, sort of the rampant, you know, sexism and, you know, women's place ideas that existed back at that time. And it is, you know, so part of the story is her, you know, part of the series is her developing into a kick-ass sleuth. And also, you know, it's a story of her and Wesley's relationship and how it develops and how it becomes quite contentious, but also like in a very good way, and how they come to so strongly rely on each other.
Yeah. And Diane does take charge at the end of the series. I mean, she basically saves Wesley and
right.
gets him the hell out of Dodge when it looks like he might not make it away from the crime scene.
She's serving notice too. She's saying, I don't necessarily at this point agree with what you're doing. I don't understand it, but I'm the one who just came and saved your ass. And it's like, I shall be treated as an equal.
Yeah, and that's good stuff. Okay, so I have to admit, I still have reservations about this comic, but just with this conversation, you're talking me back into liking this again.
Well, I recognize your concerns, and you know, some of them are very legitimate, and it is dated in some ways.
Yeah, there were, not to get into too many specifics, but there were a lot of tropes in the 90s. Of, you know, everything had to be, that whole thing about everything had to be so extreme, and certain storylines and certain techniques were used over and over and over again, not just in this comic, but in many comics, Vertigo especially, that I find tiresome. And I was kind of seeing that, and that's, I think that's where my head was at. But like I said, there's so much to like in this comic, I'm willing to put those reservations aside. There's a lot good going on here.
I mean, you know, and like any comic, there definitely are some failures here and there. But yeah. I think as a piece, it's still, I find, like rereading it, I was glad I did. And I was reminded by the things that I liked about it. And you, in some of our other conversations, you pointed out some things that I think are pretty negative about it as well. Yeah. But I think overall, the series holds up if you are entertained by a certain type of storytelling.
Yes, I would agree with that. Okay. So overall, though, I would say I'm glad I went back and read these again. I think I have a better understanding of the story. At least, it's hard to say. I remember it differently than what it is, if that makes sense.
Right.
So I'm glad I went back and I have a better understanding and a better grasp of what this series is, just by reading it again a couple decades later. I'm a much different person than I was 20 years ago. So I'm seeing it with fresh eyes. And that's good and bad.
The storytelling has changed a lot since then as well. And when also the story, when also the comic is trying to ape a storytelling from 50 years before that.
But overall, I think
a remove is from this type of storytelling is also kind of interesting. Yeah.
I appreciate it. I appreciate its ideas. It has it's trying to do something that is really admirable. Maybe it doesn't always succeed, but you know, kudos for trying. And I'm glad this exists. all right. So we done?
I think so.
All right.
So that was Sandman Mystery Theater. And Paul, I believe you are going to have a recommendation for our next session.
Yes.
Would you like to share it with the class?
I do. I am going to recommend Black Panther, specifically the Marvel Knights version by Christopher Priest. In specific, to get even more specific, Black Panther by Christopher Priest, the Complete Collection, Volume 1. This collects Black Panther Marvel Knights, Issues 1 to 17. This was a series that came out in 1998, and it kind of redefined what and who Black Panther is. It's well, I guess we'll talk about it in the next episode.
And if folks haven't already heard or it hasn't been edited out, we've had our own version of the Black Panther talking to us throughout this last little bit.
Yes. Yes. You all hear a little bit of that kitty cat in the background, so because no doubt I will not be able to get rid of all of it.
Enjoy my cat, own Black Panther.
Your cat is just musing.
Oh.
Yeah. Maybe I'll cut that out. So next time we'll be talking about Black Panther. Christopher Priest,
right.
Good stuff.
Yay.
So thanks everybody for listening. Of course, you can always, we always love your feedback. Please visit our website at collectededitionpodcast.com, where you can leave comments on individual episodes. Hit us up on Twitter, Collected Ed Pod. That's Collected ED Pod. You can also get me at Daddy Elk. And Brian, do you even remember what yours is?
Nope.
You're Big Rock something or other. Just go to Collected ED Pod. It's good enough.
What is this Twitter?
What is this Twitter thing? But of course, everybody, thanks for listening. We really appreciate you showing up. Thanks, everybody. Until next time, keep reading comics.
And be well.
You've been listening to The Collected Edition, a comic book podcast. The Collected Edition is a Daddy Elk production. All materials used on the show are copyright their respective copyright holders, and no infringement is intended. The show can be found on iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play, as well as online at collectededitionpodcast.com, where comments can be left on individual episodes. You can also send us feedback at comments@collectededitionpodcast.com or on Twitter at @CollectedEdPod. That's Collected, EDPOD. The Collected Edition, a comic book podcast, is for entertainment purposes only.
Are you not entertained? Are you not entertained?
You know, an old Golden Age character. Sandman was a Golden Age character. Hold on a second. Nux.
We got some kitties in the back.
Nucky, I fed you. I literally fed him before we did this, so he wouldn't do this. Okay, he's laying down on the floor, so that should have ended.
Okay. That's got to be... So, hey, good outtake.